This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 4th of November, 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. Today it's going to be me, David Pleasant, bringing you the show, standing in for Section D regular host Tom Morris. Coming up today, we return to the UN headquarters in New York and discover its Norwegian design heritage.
The United Nations Security Council chamber are part of the untold story of the many design gems that Norway's past has.
Then we go to Cologne, where those who buy, sell and design office furniture have their annual jamboree.
We are developing new ideas for working and living, and that leads us not to new tables or chairs, but to new concepts.
Plus, I get a private lesson in the art of fashion illustration from the author of a new book on the subject.
When I saw the old style illustrations, I didn't want to sit there and trace. I wanted there to be a risk in it of will it work, won't it work? Because drawings are exciting for me.
That's all here on Section D with me, David Pleasant, on Monocle 24. Now to start the show, I got a drawing lesson from the author of a new book that hopes to lend a skillful hand to those who want to make their imagery stand out in a very crowded field. Creative Fashion Illustration by Stuart McKenzie includes easy-to-follow exercises that are designed to build confidence and encourage experimentation. But before Stuart and I got to the drawing board, we discussed the sometimes rather rigid world of illustrating fashion.
You know, the first thing is just having a good understanding of proportion. And then once you've got that good understanding of the basic proportions of the body, then you can go away and do anything you want. You can be as experimental, as avant-garde, as fanciful as you like. But get that good grounding. You know, I've had a lot of kind of life drawing when I was at art college. So once you've mastered the basics, then it's kind of up to you how you push it. There is a notion that fashion illustration, a lot of people think of the glory days of illustration, you know, the 40s and 50s of, you know, Dior clad model with her hand on her hip, you know, the nipped in waist. So there's that cliche of a fashion illustration, the female with a hand on the hip.
And you've talked about the girl in a frock doing nothing.
Yeah, you know, these vacant looking girls, you know, they're kind of, you know, I think when I draw, I keep saying it's born out of this spontaneity. I've never really, when I saw the old style illustrations, I didn't want to sit there and trace. I just wanted to draw these illustrations straight off. So I drew and I drew and I drew until I could spontaneously draw without having to trace. I didn't think tracing was cheating, but I wanted there to be a risk in it of will it work, won't it work? You know, to keep it exciting for me, because drawings are exciting for me.
So there are ways, I mean, you've joked before about this kind of woman in a frock doing nothing, but there are ways to make it exciting. There's always a way to kind of bring that to life, even though fundamentally you might have kind of same posture, same kind of rigid positioning. I mean, because a lot of fashion illustration does have a similarity about it. No matter how well executed it is, it's got a kind of a conformity about it.
It still has to communicate an idea. You know, there's different types of illustration. There's illustration which needs to communicate an idea. I work for Vivienne Westwood. We work closely with factories. I had to go to the factory with patterns and fabrics and say, this is what you need to make. Now, if I showed them an illustration which was so creative and wonderful, but they'd look at it and say, that's a great illustration, but I don't know what's going on. So, you need to be able to communicate your ideas. So there's got to be an illustration which will do that, which will support a flat drawing. So you've got a drawing of the dress, the front, the back, the side view, any details that needs to be on there. And then you've got the kinds of illustrations, which I was lucky enough to work with Peter Saville on illustrations for Selfridges department store, which was an in-store promotion, where the only rules there was that the illustrations had to cut through in store. So when people walked in the store, they saw the illustrations, you know, and they stood out. And there I could do anything that I wanted, really. It was completely up to me. There was no restrictions in, you know, how I drew the figures.
Now, before you go, I want to get a little masterclass. So I want to pretend that I'm a fashion student. I've got lots of ideas in my head about expressing whatever concepts, but I'm just not very confident about actually drawing the form, you know, of the human body and the clothes, my concepts on that body. Can you tell me how I might start, how I would begin? If I really, you know, I'm really scared of drawing. I've just done everything on a Mac before. I'm just not much of a drawer.
I think the first thing to do is, one of the things I do with the workshops that I do, is just to free yourself up to start off with. We don't want to clutch our pens right at the tip, you know, and draw in a really rigid way. So we want to hold the pen at its end like that.
It's kind of dangling between my fingers now.
Yeah, you know, which makes your wrist a bit more supple. And if we just, because of the size of the paper, let's just start with a figure of eight like this and then break away from that figure of eight and then just scribble all over in the corner of your paper like that. So that's our little warm-up exercise. Like if you went to the gym or if you did ballet or football or anything like that, you need to warm up first. The same with drawing. You don't want to approach a drawing just being really tight and rigid. So the next thing you want to do now is just noticing things and, you know, observation. So if you just watch what I'm going to do now, I'm going to look at you, but I'm going to draw your face without lifting my pen off the paper.
Stuart is indeed looking at me and scribbling a little drawing. Yeah, I can see my beard taking shape. My eyes, really big ears, and there's me. And you're trying not to look at the paper. You're looking more at me, or both simultaneously?
A bit of both. That's your headphones, by the way, not your ears.
Oh, yes, I forgot I was wearing headphones.
There we go. So yeah. You have a quick go at drawing me.
Right. So I'm doing your forehead, and do your eyes, eyebrows, mouth, ears.
Without lifting your pen off the paper.
I was cheating there.
Okay, great. You're a natural. You've got a good line work there.
So in the book, do you kind of go, is this the first starting point?
Yeah.
That's really nice. It's kind of, it's got a really, mine doesn't, it doesn't look like a person. Yours looks, it looks almost kind of archaeological. It looks like a wonderful figurine or something from the ancient Mediterranean coast or something. It looks incredible.
Well, those are the kind of what, you know, like a quick warm-up exercise. And another one that I do is where you draw without looking at the page. But another one is just to get a bit of movement into the figure. He's just working with the idea of stick people is starting off with scribbles like this. And then you draw a head and then an arm and then a leg, a foot. And there you have a figure.
Oh, but Stuart, yours looks like a really expressive, nice, it looks almost like a logo for an Olympic Games or something. Mine looks like a branch with leaves on it. And this is kind of the form taking shape.
And yeah, so you know, and then there's small gesture drawings that you can just plan out how you'd like to. I mean, it's about the clothes. It's about how the clothes work with the body. You know, you're looking at a garment. You want to let the garment dictate how you might illustrate it. Let the garment dictate what materials you might use. You know, if you're looking at the recent collections, don't just arbitrarily draw a figure and put the clothes on. Think about what the collections are about and what the colours are, the textures, the shape, silhouette, patterns, etc. And let that all come into the illustration, because I think it's a much more exciting way to work. Reset the goalposts, I think, with illustration. Do what you'd like to see out there, not what exists already. As I said before, you need to know those basics, but once you've got those basics, it's up to you to have a lot of fun with it. But think about who it's for, what brief you're satisfying, and what needs to be communicated. And if you understand that, and then we just have a lot more fun with it.
That was Stuart McKenzie, author of new book Creative Fashion Illustration: How to Develop Your Own Style, published by Bloomsbury. You're listening to Section D with me, David Pleasant. This week, our New York Bureau Chief, Ed Stocker, is back at the UN headquarters in Midtown Manhattan. In last week's episode, Ed met the Assistant Director General of the UN, who himself is an architect. On today's show, he catches up with the Norwegian consul, Xenia Christostomidis, and speaks about the Council Chamber, a gift from Norway when construction began in the 1940s.
This is a very important part of Norwegian architectural legacy in New York, and we find that the Norwegian connections to what we like to think of as the most important room in the world are key in our efforts to promote current Norwegian design and architecture, because this particular legacy forms a backdrop and a history that's relevant today as well.
What's the overlap between the original designs from 1952 that are in the Security Council room and today? How much of an overlap is there between Norwegian design from then and now?
The Norwegian architect, Arnstein Arneberg, he was very interested in making an emphasis on local heritage, craftsmanship, things that we see are important in terms of design these days as well. And he wanted the design of the room to be of a character so neutral that, like he was saying, it could withstand the test of time. And we see that some of the features, while they are kept and renovated exactly as they were in 1952, that they still feel relevant design-wise, and that's interesting.
Tell listeners about Norway's involvement here. People might want to know why a Norwegian architect was charged with overseeing the design of the Security Council and why, you know, these Norwegian designers are featured in there. What's the link between the UN and Norway?
So the first Secretary General of the United Nations was the Norwegian lawyer and politician Trygve Lie. And when he was elected, the UN had not yet found a permanent home. And he helped secure a site for the UN's future headquarters in Manhattan. And he was instrumental in arranging for the Norwegian design of the Security Council chamber. Whether he was wise enough to foresee that that would in fact be the most important room in the UN, we don't have any historical archives stating that, but I'm guessing that he was a very pragmatic politician, and I'm certain that he saw that it made sense to connect his country to what became and still is the most important room in the world. So Norway gave the Security Council chamber as a gift to the United Nations in 1952, and our involvement in the design and architecture currently also features funding to the UN in connection to the grand renovation process that they've gone through recently. And we're honored to not only have been the country that has donated this room, but also helped restore it recently. We think of it as the most important room in the world.
Obviously, the, you know, what's great and credible about the Security Council is how enduring it has proved, as you were saying. The design of the round table, the chairs, even the mural that hangs on the wall. How does Norway feel, if you can sum that up, about the fact that perhaps Swedish and Danish mid-century design gets more press than Norway does?
Well, this is one of the reasons why we are, from the Norwegian side, trying to promote and make well-known the wonderful design and architectural legacy that is in the Security Council chamber. You're absolutely right. Norway has had a position as the underdog in the design world for a long time. When people think of Scandinavian design, Norway is often left out of it. But we see that that is changing. Norway is sort of gaining momentum on design internationally, and we think telling the story of what Norway used to offer is also important. The United Nations Security Council chamber and the room's very specific Norwegian links are in some ways part of the untold story of the many design gems that Norway's past has. So it's an interesting story that needs to be told.
Well, I'm interested in this link between past and present. How would you assess, I guess, the state of Norwegian design today?
It's vital, it's innovative, it's leaning forward to a different extent than previous years. We have many new, young, wonderful designers who are really making their mark internationally. And I also think back in Norway that there is an enhanced understanding of the importance of design and architecture. So Norway is sort of having a moment, design and architectural-wise.
That was our New York Bureau Chief, Ed Stocker, bringing us that interview with Norwegian Consul at the UN, Xenia Chrysostomidis, on Norway's rather overlooked design heritage. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, where we return after this short break.
A fresh generation is falling in love with Warsaw's Mokotów neighbourhood, so Monocle Films headed to Poland to experience the palpable vibrancy of this creative community.
I feel like here everyone is very kind of patriotic about being a Mokotów inhabitant. There's this feeling of growth and optimism here. So I would say that's what creates our attachment to this area.
Property Perspective Mokotów. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
Hello. Hello and welcome back to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, David Pleasant. Melissa and its famous plastic sandals is one of the most recognisable Brazilian brands in the world. No surprise, really, as they're selling their products in some 84 countries. Now, they also have three shops called Galleria Melissa, extravagant retail spaces where Melissa shoes are put on the podium. Sao Paulo, New York, and as of October, London is graced with a Galleria Melissa, right in the middle of Covent Garden. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco paid a visit to the new London store and met Eduardo Jordão de Magalhães, responsible for Melissa's international marketing.
The shop is called Galleria Melissa. Galleria Melissa is a concept that we started in São Paulo 10 years ago with an amazing project by Muti Randolph. Muti Randolph is the same designer who designed this store here. We privilege in our company three pillars: fashion, design, and art. And in the three Galleria Melissas that we have these three pillars well defined.
Where are those three Galleria Melissas? Can you tell us?
The first one is in São Paulo, Brazil. It's a seminal project. It's one of the most beautiful stores, I think, in Brazil. It became a destination shop. It's at Rua Oscar Freire. Second one, also very beautiful, it's in Soho, New York, in Green Street, a different concept, but also aligned with this idea of technology and art. And the third one, as you said, on this prime location in Covent Garden, is the biggest one, the second international, and it's a temple of design.
How would you, I mean, of course, we're here in the UK, even though there's we have a lot of tourists here, but how would you have something different for the customer here in the UK compared to the other shops?
Every shop is different. The first one in São Paulo, we have a big facade that changes every 3 months where we display different ideas and different artworks. The second one in New York, it's more internal. The surprise happens inside the store. The experience is more internal. This one, we have two floors. The first floor, where you have the shop, which is a very interesting space where we have the most amazing technology available in the market with LED screens. Actually, it's the biggest LED screen in the UK, where we display videos and interactive images. And the whole space that is fantastic. But I think the whole story with Melissa is how we relate to our customers. It's really an emotional relationship because Melissa is a love brand. And being a love brand, we have a lot of respect with our customers. And this is, I think, makes the big difference with the other stores and creates a link between our stores.
And the other thing, of course, I have to mention, I mean, Melissa is, of course, a Brazilian brand, but at the same time, it's very, very international. I mean, can you tell us about which countries, I mean, do you sell Melissa? And also about those the international cooperations you do with designers like Karl Lagerfeld?
Yes, Melissa started in 1979. It's part of a company called Grandene. It's going to celebrate its 35th anniversary now, this year, with a big event in São Paulo. But it is a Brazilian brand, but an international brand. We are now selling our products in over 80 countries, 84 if I'm not mistaken. And the collaboration projects that we have with the designers actually started in 1980. Melissa is a pioneer of collaborations. Since the 80s, we have done several important collaborations with designers like Thierry Mugler, Jean-Paul Gaultier, Elisabeth de Senneville, and many others. So part of our DNA is this collaboration projects, and we have done a few very important. I could mention Zaha Hadid, the architect, the Campana brothers, Karim Rashid, Gaetano Pesce, Karl Lagerfeld, Vivienne Westwood, Gareth Pugh, just to name a few.
And I wonder, I mean, the brand is doing already very well, but do you have even plans for even further expansion?
We have a plan for another Galleria Melissa, which will be the fourth in Asia, and probably that will happen within the next 2 or 3 years, but we still haven't decided where. But yes, we have plans for expansion.
Of course, Asia in general is a very good market for Monaco as well. So is Melissa well known in Asia, maybe in Japan or something like that?
Yes, Japan has always been a fantastic country and has always received Melissa very well. It is one of the cities, Tokyo, that we are thinking alongside with Shanghai, but we are still working on it.
That was Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking to Eduardo Jordão de Magalhães from Brazilian brand Melissa. Still to come on Section D, we'll be getting a tour of the world's most important office furniture fair in Germany, using some water pipes to inhale Belgian gastronomy rather than tobacco, and I get on the couch and speak to two editors about furniture, and not just the immaculate brand new variety. At the end of last month, Orgatech, the 5-day leading international trade fair for the office, was held in Cologne. Orgatech is where international brands and designers come together to showcase the most innovative creations and developments. Best workplace design seems in constant flux, open plan or sectioned, sitting or standing, in linear form or in clusters. So Monocle's Marie-Sophie Schwarzer journeyed to Cologne to tell us more about this year's trends.
This year, Cologne once again hosted Orgatech, the leading international trade fair for modern office furniture and fixtures. Over 624 companies from 41 countries presented their most innovative designs across 6 halls at the Köln Messe. Among them, Swiss brands Novex and Vitra, US-based Hayworth and Canadian studio Molo. More than 50,000 visitors hailing from 120 nations had a look around the biennial fair, and so did we. Our first stop is Novex, all the way in Hall 8, where export manager Wilhelm Zutte introduces us to this year's fair and the timeless wood and steel desks, cupboards, and shelves that characterize the Lucerne-based brand that is currently celebrating its 80th anniversary and furnished a large part of our office at Midori House.
Our main theme this year is modularity. That's the basis of all our products. So we developed the idea of modular acoustics because this is one of the main trends for the next years. We have two trends for the medium future. One is acoustics and the other one is how to develop in the future the open space.
Orgatech sets trends and Swiss brand Vitra is always one step ahead. Its large-scale exhibition space at the heart of the fair showcases their newest collection in an interactive and theatrical way. While a number of visitors are attempting to fold up one of Konstantin Grick's mobile hack tables inspired by Silicon Valley's offices, we take a seat in one of Ronan and Erwin Borolek's modular workspaces with General Manager of Vitra Germany, Rudolf Pütz, who tells us more about the 1950 founded brand and its latest designs.
Vitra is traditionally working with the best designers. And together with these designers, we think about what is going on in the society, in the companies, and we are developing new ideas for working and living today and in the future. And that leads us not to new tables or chairs, but to new concepts.
One of the displays that truly stands out is Vitra's new Prouvé Raw Office Edition, created for the Rem Koolhaas designed G-Star headquarters in Amsterdam. A vintage sewing machine, spools of thread in military hues, stonewashed jeans, and recreated 1950s Jean Prouvé desks and chairs fill the space. Pütz tells us more about the industrial collection that was created to reflect G-Star's brand philosophy.
It's really an amazing example, this cooperation with G-Star. They transform the identity and the character of the brand within the workspace so that people every day feel it, the CI and the DNA of this company. And especially for G-Star, they are engineering their denim jeans and the source for this close bridge to Jean Prouvé, because Jean Prouvé was an engineer and he made really very true products, yeah, with steel, with aluminium and wood. And G-Star took this tradition and transformed it in a new concept, in a new furniture for their new headquarters, with this fantastic new building from Rem Koolhaas. And it gives this headquarters a really a fantastic look. It's this industrial workshop, yeah, that's the end, it's the character of the office. And it's completely different from all the other boring offices, you know, from the big companies. Yeah? The potential of space, they use the potential of space to support their brand and their corporate strategy.
Opposite Vitra's eye-catching stand, US-based company Hayworth is presenting their newest adaptable workplaces, including OpenNest, a seating area by Patricia Orcuola, and a height-adjustable desk system that lets you wirelessly charge your phone and whose desk lamps change color to suit your mood. Red for busy, please do not disturb, green for happy to chat, and so on. Hayworth's Vice President Henning Figge tells us more about the foreseeable trends.
This year's fair, the trend that we have seen and recognized in our research is really going into creating atmospheres, special atmospheres. And this is, of course, collaborative areas growing in their importance. And there's a trend to a more residential touch and feel. And so atmosphere is being perceived in terms of colors, in terms of materiality, in terms of lighting, in terms of acoustics, in terms of the play of transparency and enclosures. And that is the big theme also of our booth here at Orgatech in Cologne.
After resting in the open nest, structured like a bird's nest, where the coffee tables are the branches and the chairs the chicks, we continue on our way and notice wonderful paper installations in the hallway that combine seating with sculptural elements. Finally, we have the pleasure of meeting Stephanie Forsyth, the Canadian-born designer behind these artistic creations, which include dividing paper walls that compress to 1/100th of their expanded size and sound-absorbing ambience lights.
Molo was founded in 2004. My husband and I are architects, and so we started it with literally folding some pieces of paper and thinking about how to make flexible space. And coming to Orgatech, we were thinking about workspaces, of course, and started to play with different types of tables. And one of the playful things that emerged were these paper top tables. So the top surface of the table is literally a stack of paper for sketching and brainstorming. And I think the more successful ones are the tall standing height ones. You can imagine a number of people all kind of coming together quite casually around a standing height table, working out some ideas, and then back to wherever they go. And one nice thing about it is it's circular, and in the same way that the circular center of a Chinese dinner table rotates, the circular sheets of paper can rotate around the little paper pencil holder at the center. So as you're working on something, you kind of spin it around, the person across from you can build on the same sketch idea, and so forth.
It's brilliant. So Mola really fosters creativity in people and tries to bring a little more collaborative spirit to the office.
Yeah, I think that's what it's all about, right? And we spend a third of our lives all working in some kind of space, so it's an important part of the world to think about, of course. So we created three fairly large installations for socializing. The idea was to create these informal opportunities for people to meet one another between traveling the fair and sit, rest, relax, check your messages, you know, make notes, make your plans, or have a little meeting. And we built a hill out of paper, so people climb up these steps made out of paper within these kind of tiers of the hill and sit on different levels. And I wasn't sure if people would be brave enough to stand on the paper because a lot of people, especially if they know you're watching, they're more careful. They look at the seat, they touch it, they think, oh, will it hold me? This is only paper. But people were walking on it, standing on it, sitting on it, laying on it. It's really nice. And one of the things that happens is that the paper does show an aging from all of this wear, but it's a nice aging. When you look at it now at the end of the show, it's easier to recognize paper as a material that comes from trees. Somehow these forms look like very much something that came from nature and belongs to nature, would go back to nature.
The long week has come to an end, and the last visitors are making their way to the exit. After seeing hundreds of chairs and desks, one thing is clear. The office of the future will give us more freedom and flexibility. We'll be able to work by ourselves in enclosed spaces, in small groups or even large teams. We'll be able to stand or sit at our desks and recreate a sheltered lounge as our office begins to resemble our house more and more. So get ready to feel at home in your office.
That was Monocle's Marie-Sophie Schwarzer reporting from Orgatech. the Office Furniture International Trade Fair in Cologne. You're listening to Section D, brought to you by me, David Pleasant. The act of smoking has gone through some very radical transformations over the last few years, electronic cigarettes being the main example. But now, the traditional water pipe, also known as a nargile, hookah or shisha, is on the verge of finding a new use that has nothing to do with tobacco. Last month at the Biennale Interieur Design Fair in the Belgian city of Kortrijk, 2007 winner of the fair's Designer of the Year was back to showcase her winning design with an all-new use. Neda Al-Azma's sleekly designed water pipe has been adapted to be used in the world of gastronomy. Little wonder, as chefs from Belgium to Barcelona have become so intrigued by the capabilities of new technology. I spoke to Neda and also Eric Germond, who is overseeing the pipes at the fair.
I've designed a water pipe in the time for the French company RDM. And now, in fact, the water pipe is a device used for the concept of aroma vapology. And aroma vapology is a concept that has been just recently developed by RDM. What does that mean, aroma vapology? It's, in fact, it's no tobacco. It is minerals that are used with natural essential oil like geranium or cardamom or a cognac, a little bit of cognac in the water. And what you are doing is, in fact, you're smoking flavors, you're tasting flavors. It's not, I mean, it's like, as well, a new way of food pairing. So there are quite a lot of star chefs working for the moment in France around the aroma vapology, and they're creating their own, like if you make a bouillon or fish stock, in fact, you can just smoke your fish stock. And if you put like some essential oil of geranium and you eat a piece of parmesan, the flavor of your parmesan will be like really different. Some taste will come above that you won't normally taste. So
this is really kind of blending two very separate traditions, the one of smoking a pipe and that of gastronomy. Is that what?
That's right. So the next step will be like developing, in fact, a device for really for the aroma vapology. But now we're using the water pipe because that's, in fact, a device that is very good for that.
I'm starting to smell some things. Is there, or is that just my imagination?
You can smoke some cardamom, some tonka. It's a cacao bean, so it's chocolate in milk. There is some salt with truffle. And a cognac, so.
And do you envisage this product, it will be available in restaurants, in kind of haute cuisine environments?
So this is like the development that is now going on. And this is then the devices we will develop really for the restoration, so for the restaurants.
It's quite interesting how you've adapted your kind of approach. So can we talk about the actual design of the object, really? I mean, this is something that you developed for tobacco use.
Yeah.
And so maybe tell us about the form of it. I mean, it's a fantastic visual concept.
Yeah. So the company RDM, when they approached me to design a water pipe, I was quite interested to do it because often they say like, yeah, but your background, it's because of your background you've done that water pipe. No, I mean, okay, I'm half Palestinian, half Belgian. So I do have like references to water pipe. Like I remember my grandma smoking the water pipe, but the approach to the product is exactly the same approach as I would design like cutlery or a mussel pot that is a very typical Belgian product.
And actually, there is on the banner of your stand, there's some mussels next to the water pipe. You're really trying to kind of show that juxtaposition.
Well, yeah, that's it exactly. But you can smoke, in fact. You can smoke the mussels. So this is why I've like decided to do it. It's like, how you say it,
twist.
A twist. It's a twist that I've done. So for me as well, like the water pipe, it's a ritual. That you have to take time, it's time sharing, you have to sit down, you have to prepare your shisha. And so for me as well, it was important to design something that is as well functionally working very well, because a lot of shishas are like very badly made and so on. So I've done like research as well, the way how, where the part where the charcoal has to come, the tobacco has to come and so on.
Avoided design in a way, some of the shisha, I mean, they're kind of antique designs in their own way, but you kind of taking it further.
I thought, why not? We're living nowadays, so, but let us please keep the tradition of smoking it. And we don't always need to have like the traditional object, so we can have like a contemporary one as well. So,
and before I let you go, do you think we could try? Can we try? It's quite tempting.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. The whole thing is, as long as you haven't tried it, you don't understand the whole concept. So, it is important to try it. for me was exactly the same. When the company told me about it, I just thought, like, what are they talking about? I'm not getting it. But the moment I tried it, I was like, said, like, okay, this is like really interesting. So please.
So maybe as we're in Belgium and we're looking at some chocolate, can we try something now?
Yes, for sure. So that means that I will take this tube, place an individual mouthpiece on the tube, inhale a little bit. I get out the vapor. I will have this black chocolate into my mouth. And I've got a real pairing, sublime pairing of two flavors altogether.
That's the cardamom, you say?
Yes.
That's wonderful aromatic scent. Yeah.
And let's say if we go to the vapor of white truffle, the interesting things with it is that it's very fiddle. It's really something that is smelling. You've got a real taste of
faithful.
Truffle. It's not so strong as a white truffle. You may have it all the day long, i.e. no season for it. We've got the truffle into some salt for 7 days, and so the truffle gave its taste to the salt, then place the salt into the water, mix it, and you will have this real truffle in your mouth.
That was Eric Guermond sampling the gastronomic capabilities of Belgian designer Neda El Asma's water pipes. You're listening to Section D with me, David Pleasant, where we'll be back after this.
Every weekday at 1800 hours London time, join one of Monocle's editors and their panel of special guests for an in-depth roundtable discussion of the day's key news stories.
It's not the West or the outside, the international community trying to do something in Iraq. It's about the international community trying to support an Iraqi effort.
Fresh and passionate insight from leading international voices on global affairs, politics and business here in London.
I was in the south, in Sangin, in Helmand province. What I saw there makes me pretty confident that within a year of the troops going, the south will fall to the Taliban.
And of course, we bring you reviews of the best in film, music, theatre and literature from all around the world.
Every single character is an eccentric. It's all, oh, Bagara, she thought her husband was a potato. I'm astonished that it's on the Booker long list.
Hear the sharpest views and insights on the big issues of the day. Get up to speed on how to add to your cultural wealth as well. That's all on Midori House, Monday through Friday at 1800 hours London time.
Welcome back to Section D with me, David Pleasant. Berry Brothers and Rudd is Britain's oldest wine and spirit merchants and have been trading in the same shop in London for over 300 years. Earlier this year, the company decided to overhaul its identity for the first time since the 1980s. It seems fitting that the company might choose Pentagram, a British design studio whose output consistently represents some of the best of what is being done in London. Monocle's Carlotta Ribello spoke to one of Pentagram's partners, Harry Pierce, about how to give such an established British brand an appropriately contemporary new identity.
They're a very progressive company, which is, I mean, they've been around for way over 300 years, but they are constantly kind of on their toes. And I think they were re-looking at their whole website, the whole retail interior, the whole way the company was setting itself for the next 20, 25 years. I mean, that's how far ahead they look when they're looking at the nature of wine and the nature of the company. So I think it was just a fitting time, realizing they were making other changes and they wanted to just really originally ensure that they were in tune with their aspirations for the future. So that's what it began as, a review. And the real inspiration was that I just spent actually days and days in both in their incredibly old cellars in St. James's in London, as well as in their sort of super modern warehouses out in Basingstoke. And this is the beauty of what they do. They're sort of ultra modern, but with this incredible heritage at the same time. And I just spent literally days photographing old wines, new wines, spirits, and in their old cellars and their modern warehouses, and just try to find a theme and a seam, like a little bloodline that could go back through everything. And really, typography was a big part of it. But I found a few old logos that felt timeless. And I wanted to create the identity so it didn't feel like it had a designer's hand on it, that it actually felt authentic and that it had been part of the brand forever. And that's really what I did.
During your time there at the warehouses and at the cellars, was there any particular detail that caught your attention?
Well, as I said, there was just a huge kind of tapestry of rich, rich pickings from a design point of view. I mean, the labels went back centuries, and this beautiful typography seemed to be the kind of essence of things. But I found a collection of labels that actually stretched back beyond the beginning of the 19th century that had a simplicity to them. They just had a very ordinary, straightforward little logo at the top of every label. And beneath that, many of the labels were written by hand. And there seemed this wonderful sort of idiosyncratic charm to that. And I've got to say, if you looked at them, you couldn't really say what era it came from. And so I took a selection of these and created a logo from this lovely old mark. And that's become the current logo. So it's been cleaned and made a little bit more robust, but it's essentially been there for a very, very long time, but it feels quite contemporary.
Talk us a bit through the visuals of this new identity for Brary Brothers and Rudd.
Everything had its source, even though I've modernized lots of parts of it, everything had its source from somewhere in the past. So I wasn't trying to do a kind of cliche with any of it, but I just wanted to make it authentic, but modernized. So for instance, you've got the main logo, but there's also this little mark that we use, which is the tail end for everything. It's on the back of all the labels, it's on all the boxes, which is a little cask, and it's a redrawing of a very old cask that they used to stamp onto things, long lost in history, but we've redrawn it, and it's actually quite an odd shape, and we've just kept all those idiosyncratic, odd anomalies that are in it as part of the charm. And it's so much of what the brand's about. There's things like typography, as you can imagine. It's the real soul of wine labels. So typography is a very big part of the brand, and photography too. So there's been a lot of photography going on all around the world. Geordie Willis, who's the design or brand director of Brary Brothers and Rudd, has been photographing vineyards, like I say, across the globe, but none of them has he been shooting with kind of sunsets and whatever. We've just been trying to shoot the things you catch out the side of your eye, so some rusty old tools in the corner of a shed or some sort of half-broken sign. And it's all about the intimacy and the beauty of the real sort of hardcore process of making wine. And he's literally traveling the world. And it's part of the narrative of how we talk about Brary Brothers and Rudd. So it's not your polished view of the world of winemaking. It's the more authentic, genuine sort of dirt under the fingernails approach.
With this type of project and this type of client, I must assume this is really easy to use the cliches or over vintage aesthetic in a way. Was that a main challenge to keep away from that?
It was a challenge, yeah, because you could drop into it easily. You could, you know, if I looked at a lot of other brands that are very similar to them, and you know, they stick the raw warrants in a certain place above the logo, centered on the, and it's just, there's just such a obvious route to take. And so what we did with this was just not allow that to happen. We, you know, the warrants have been separated from the logo. Things sit in odd places. And they are a really, truly idiosyncratic brand. And the building, if you just go to travel through the building in St. James's, everything's uneven. The art around the place is kind of really eclectic and wonderfully odd. And it was easy to keep that stuff in rather than chase the cliches. It wasn't that hard a battle, actually. It was easy.
And can we say that there's a Britishness to the end result?
I hope so. There's, again, I keep going back to that word idiosyncratic, but we actually wrote it into the kind of the brand rules of how we made the identity come to life. But I think that there's craft in the winemaking, and there's craft in the actual nature of the visual identity. Every little tiny detail has been kind of honed right down, and just the way things are put together, it's about craft, simplicity, and I guess it's about honouring the past, but in a really kind of modern, robust way for the future. It's not, it'd be very easy just to look back. And I think that what makes it the British is it's not just that, it's blending a kind of modernism with the old stuff too.
That was Monocle's Carlotta Rebello speaking to Pentagram's Harry Pierce about the new identity for British wine and spirit merchant Brary Brothers and Rudd. To end this episode of Section D, we go back to furniture. New biannual magazine title, Dirty Furniture, seeks to investigate the role, history and concept of furniture, rather than simply display it. This is no mean feat in an industry that is pretty attached to looking immaculate. For the first issue, Dirty Furniture centres its gaze on the couch, so often the showpiece of any furniture brand's collection. Co-founders and editors Anna Bates and Lizzie Glickfield sat down with me on a sofa here at Midori House for a little design cushion talk.
Each of the issues of dirty furniture takes a piece of furniture as its theme. And we're starting with couch. We want to sort of map the domestic landscape. So the next will be table, then we move on to closet, toilet, bed, and we also have telephone.
Looking through dirty furniture, you're actually quite kind of straightforward and kind of matter of fact about what you're trying to do. You're trying to really kind of open up the debate really about kind of design, would you say? I mean, what do you think is lacking in terms of not just design publishing, but also the kind of what's written, what's thought, how people view design? Do you think there's something a bit kind of missing, people missing a trick in a way?
I think, look, we see that there's a lot of good stuff out there. We don't want to really want to be seen as saying that there's a dearth of things, but we're all just aware of there are a lot of sort of great writers. I guess we figure that the discipline of design writing and design history is a lot, compared to, say, art writing, is a lot less defined. And we just wanted to create a space where some of those writers could perhaps do some more interesting types of writing about design other than perhaps a standard profile or a piece which tells you about the inspiration behind the design of an object.
Maybe go into some of the kind of intrigue or interesting stories that you've come across and that you know, you perhaps have been surprised by. People think of the sofa as perhaps something taken for granted. There's a lot more to it than that, isn't there? Maybe tell us some of the different aspects of the sofa that you've come across.
We were very aware that you go to these design fairs and you are literally surrounded by couches. They're big things as well. So, you know, you walk around, they get to dominate the whole space. And we knew very little about this piece of furniture. I mean, I guess it started really on Google, you know, like everything does. And we just started typing in couch and just the strangest things came up. And then just digging through with our co-founder, Peter Maxwell, we were rummaging through, design history books and just all of those. I guess when you take a subject, when you make something like a couch your subject, all those strange references, or every time you've heard that word couch, it all sort of comes together. We just found these stories and these anecdotes just kept popping up.
So you've come across some of these, I don't know if I can point one out for you. So I like this one, the amount of loose change which gets lost under couch cushions and other pieces of furniture in the US is $15 billion. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
So, I mean, how the hell anybody found out that fact? I've got no idea. So, I mean, just all these sort of snippets of information. We wanted to create this sort of world, I guess, around this piece of furniture. And there's another anecdote there on the haunted couch, a couch that's at a secondhand shop in Texas somewhere, I think, and has sort of now valued at £3,000 or whatever. And it's just sort of, I guess, these strange sort of anecdotes are a way for us to reflect on things like the value of furniture, because, I mean, we're laughing at the fact that this haunted sofa is going for £3,000, but we put all sorts of value on furniture that are no less strange than that. So it just creates a different way for us to reflect on the things that we're looking at every day.
You kind of set about on an investigation on why the sofa remains so stubborn. Maybe explain that. I mean, it is kind of like the flagship piece, statement piece of a lot of designers, if we think about the big Italian brands and so on. The kind of like connotations of laziness around the whole sofa concept, would you agree? I mean, what did you discover on your investigation?
Well, just that, I mean, despite it sort of changing shape throughout history and, you know, hundreds of times, it's not really developed that much as a piece of furniture. And we just became quite interested in, I guess, things like logistics and distribution and how these sort of factors can influence the way that, or the things that we have in our lounge that we surround ourselves with. I don't know about you, but I've always found that a lot of sofas are unnecessarily big and bulky. And it was quite interesting speaking to somebody at, you know, this manufacturer and finding out that part of the reason for that is to sort of protect these sofas when they're in the lorry. You know, it's kind of like their own padding, their own packaging is sort of performing a kind of protective layer around their very sort of maybe slightly flimsy, delicate, cheap frames. So it's interesting to dissect a piece of furniture in that kind of way, as opposed to what were the designer's influences, what were their ideals, and take a different sort of approach. But that is very much, I guess, we wanted to have a piece in the magazine that grounds the sofa in reality, that, you know, a lot of our other pieces look very laterally at, you know, or they take the sofa as a subject matter and we're looking at politics and, you know, we've got a feminist piece, but we wanted that one that sort of kept it grounded in reality. And I guess that was the duty of us as editors to provide that one.
And finally, if we look to the next object, the next piece of furniture, the next dirty piece of furniture, what do you know what's coming? Can you tell us which one? Or have you not decided yet? You've listed which ones they will be, but which one is it?
Table.
Table. So quite a challenge, I imagine. It's more so than a sofa.
I think so, actually. Yeah, I mean, we're finding that there's something, I mean, the sofa can only be a sofa. You know, it's not an armchair even, it's a sofa. And, you know, a table could be a desk, it could be in the kitchen, it could be, you know, here, it could be as a coffee table. It's just, there's more functions. Tables have more uses, in a sense, than a sofa. So we've got to do a bit of work just narrowing it down so that it doesn't just become a magazine about absolutely everything.
I have to say that the kind of schoolboy humour in me is quite looking forward to the toilet issue. I think that'll be quite an interest.
Everybody seems to be looking forward to the toilet issue.
We've had a lot of people getting back saying, oh yeah, no, I've got lots of ideas for dirty furniture, but definitely, yeah, I've got something to write the toilet issue. Either that or sex. Everybody sees dirty furniture and they instantly think, oh, you know, sex on tables, sex in the toilet, sex, you know. Just, yeah, somehow appeals to people's dirty minds.
That was me talking to Anna Bates and Lizzie Glickfield, co-founders and editors of new design title Dirty Furniture. And that's all we have time for on Section D. Today's show was edited by Alex Funnell. I'm David Pleasant, and you can contact me at dmp@monocle.com if you want to feature on the show or have any comments or questions. And playing you out, we have The Kinks with Sitting on My Sofa. Thanks for listening.